Unbelievable. I know, okay, before you say it, I've heard it before, Chris. You'll lose your job, blah, 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 loss of trust. You won't, Chris. You won't lose your job. Police talk to the press all the time. That's life. It's not like I'm asking you for the nuclear codes or anything. I just want a vague update on what's going on with this case. Something I can package up nicely and sell to editors. I'm doing as much research and tracking on this as you are, honey. I'm on message boards all day, Twitter feeds, you name it. If we share information, then surely everybody wins, right? What do you think? Chris sits down slowly opposite her, palms on the table, weighing up all she's said. He does worry he's holding her back, that someday she'll hate him for it. Okay. He pauses, then lets out a low groan. Something. Oh God, okay. This is what I can tell you. But don't go crazy with this, you promise? He knows with absolute certainty that he can't ever mention Marnie, but he can give his wife something. I promise. Zara purses her lips, trying to mask her moment of pure triumph. Okay, Chris pauses, thinking it through one last time. It should be all right to tell her this. The doctor they sent up today, Dr. Lewis. She's a specialist from London. She was hired by, well, let's put it this way. Our orders at the station are now coming in from slightly higher up the food chain than before. Zara's brow knits together. It looks like the government have stepped in on this in some way. Chris clarifies. They're trying to keep everything locked down up here around this guy for some reason, and before you ask, I don't know what the reason for that is. I have no idea. Zara nods thoughtfully. Chris continues. And this fucking hotline is completely swamped, I see. There's too many calls to process, too many leads. Ever since the story broke, we've got people calling saying he's an illegal immigrant, people saying he's their missing husband or missing son, people saying he looks like an actor they recognise from TV, people saying they saw him in Scotland the day before. You name it, people are saying it. He stops, noticing Zara reach for her mobile phone. So don't write anything about the station, Z. You can write about other stuff, but not the station. We're handling it. Sure, no problem. I'll leave you guys out of it. She rises, leans over the table, and kisses his forehead in one quick motion. Thank you, thank you, thank you. I love you. She sing-songs as she dances back to her laptop. Chris sighs. He lets his forehead rest flat on the table in front of him for a second. As she wanders back in, he raises his head to look up at her. And Chris, hun, you can't say any more about the government thing, can you? She asks. Chris lets out another groan. No, okay, don't worry, she adds hastily. But this doctor, who is she? I mean, has she done anything like this before? Has she worked for the government on anything else? Oh shit, not Marnie. He raises his head now. He thought if he gave Zara something to go on, she'd be happy. I don't know, he replies. I don't know if she has, but I doubt it. Zara looks up sharply at this. Why do you doubt it? I don't know, Chris flounders. I guess she's youngish. Well, about my age. Shit, he thinks. And I don't know, she just seems, well, as in the dark about this as everyone else, from what I sensed. Meeting her today. Chris is a bad liar. He knows this. Better to just avoid questions in the future, he thinks. Thankfully, Zara seems satisfied by his awful answer and wanders out of the kitchen. He lets the tension in his shoulders release and gently rests his head back on the tabletop again. He wonders if Emma has worked for the government before, because it's incredibly strange that they chose her for this job, considering her history up here. Whoever assigned her must have known what happened, and surely they'd realise how much the press finding out about it would harm the investigation, wouldn't they? But the press won't find out, he tells himself. He'll make sure of that. But if someone else recognizes her, he wouldn't be able to control that. Hell, he'd recognized her right away. But then he would, wouldn't he? He'd spent the formative years of his life staring at her and her brother across classrooms and playing fields. Other people might not have looked so hard. They might not see Marnie's features hidden in Emma's adult face. There's no way Zara will see it. Emma Lewis doesn't look anything like Marnie Beaufort, that's for sure. Not anymore. Later that night, while Chris is brushing his teeth in the bathroom, his mobile phone receives a text message. Zara leans across the bed and checks it. There's no name for this contact on his phone, just a number she doesn't recognize. Sorry to text so late. Would it be possible to get a list of past employees at Waltham House? I can't say why just yet, but I think it might be helpful. Also, might have to rain check that drink. Snowed under. Pun intended. Emma, kiss. Zara stares at the words intently, as all the possible permutations of what they could mean blow like a forest fire through her mind, leaving sadness in their wake. The sounds of Chris pottering in the bathroom drift into her. She opens her mouth to call to him, so he can explain. Tell her it's all a misunderstanding, she's got the wrong end of the stick, but she stops herself. Better to wait and see, she reasons. After all, if she asks him now, he might lie, and she's not sure she could handle that. And after a moment that seems to stretch back through their entire lives together, Zara places Chris's phone back down where she found it. She wriggles quietly down into the soft, comforting cotton of their bed and reaches up to turn out her bedside light. Chapter 25. Dr. Emma Lewis. Day 9. The night it happened. Chris didn't text me back. But that doesn't mean anything, does it? He was probably already asleep. Lucky sod. I look down at my mobile on the bench next to me. The clock reads 2 a.m. I can't sleep. Guilt and too many thoughts, too many feelings are flowing through me. And I've only been back one day. I sip my tea and look up at the stars. I've come out again for fresh air. Thought about jumping in the car and driving all the way to the petrol garage to buy a packet of cigarettes, but I made a steamy mug of tea instead and came out here to clear my head. It's not as scary out here as it was before. The darkness is somehow comforting. Looking up past the trees, I can see the glittering arc of the Milky Way carving across the night sky. It's beautiful. But everything here reminds me of the past, of what happened, especially this sky. I'm so tired of trying not to think about it. It was bonfire night, 14 years ago. Most years we'd spend it at home. We'd help Dad light our own bonfire in the top field, pile on dried leaves and fallen branches, cardboard and old paper. Dad would set up elaborate firework displays while we fetched him coffee to keep him warm. Sometimes a school friend could come over, one of Joe's or mine. Sometimes some of Mum and Dad's friends came over. They'd drink Glühwein and chat with our parents as they perched, where they could, blankets on knees. The garden would be rigged with Catherine wheels, thin Roman candles, and tightly packed rockets dotted around the lawn, ready to be lit. Joe and I would have hot chocolate with tiny little marshmallows melting into gloop on its surface, and chase each other round with sparklers, carving our names in light into the air. But we didn't do that this year. We went somewhere new, which should have raised some red flags at the time, but it didn't. That night we headed to the county fireworks display at Holcomb Park. We all piled into the Range Rover, and Dad drove us out there, the red tail lights ahead of us building as we headed towards Holcomb. When we got to the gravel car park, we joined the bustling throngs of families carrying rugs and hampers as they poured into the parkland, walking the chalkstone track towards the distant lights of the event. It was freezing that November. We'd wrapped up warm, hats, scarves, shakeable pocket warmers. Mum covered every eventuality. The green was skirted by a temporary village of stalls offering refreshments and early Christmas gifts. Mum trekked off across the half-light of the field and brought us back a steaming jacket potato each, filled with beans and butter and melting cheese, which we scooped greedily into our mouths with plastic spoons, the foil hot in our gloved hands as we made our way to the main event. In the distance, we could see its peaks burning. Past the stalls and over the treetops, the spires of it roaring into the night sky, the bonfire. The biggest I'd ever seen, constructed in the centre of flat parkland, towering over the surrounding landscape. The crowd was more thickly packed here, a looping semicircle around the enormous flaming pyre, the low hum of happy chat as everyone stood and watched, bursts of laughter, cheers as a log or some other structure within the flames crumbled in a sudden burst of sparks, the occasional whistle and wave to straggling family members. We stood pressed close to each other, the four of us, the smell of Mum's perfume, Dad's jacket, the orange glow of the burning mound playing across our faces, its warmth bathing us. Dad broke out the sparklers, other families around us shrieking and laughing as they used theirs. I remember him fumbling through his pockets to find the clear blue lighter Mum usually used for the kitchen candle. But after a while, he decided he must have left it on the counter at home. Little things like that stick in my mind. The clues he left me, sprinkled throughout the night. Dad asked another man if we could borrow matches, and he lit our sparklers with them. I remember looking down at the sparkler in my hand, its sharp white petals flashing in and out between my fingers, shapes drawn in the air, an afterglow on the eyes, the scent of chestnuts and fire. I burned my fingers holding the stick too long, and Joe told me I was stupid not to have dropped it sooner. Mum brought us four bright red toffee apples, the coating thin enough to crack straight through in a bite, the apple beneath dense with sugar. A full orchestra played that night, gargantuan gothic symphonies and soft dreamscape concertos as we watched crates, logs, leaves, old furniture and other detritus burst into flames, becoming beautiful again. We stood and watched it all burn, from the red ember at its centre up into the crisscrossing maze at its heart to the pale cream of the cresting flames lapping the black night. And in the sky above, flecks of bright burning gold breaking free and floating. And higher still above that, the stars, the whole glittering firmament. So many stars. The music swelled and then the firework display began. The first crack and flash of pure white light shot straight up into the chilly winter air, an explosion of diamond dust. And then colour after colour, faster and brighter and louder, until the whole sky was lit with pulsing, flashing magic. Then as swiftly as it started, it was gone. The night sky empty, but for the afterimage on our eyes, and the ghost of smoke in the wind. I stare into the starlit sky above Cuckoo Lodge and I close my eyes. Such a beautiful night. I try not to feel guilty for what happened next. It wasn't my fault. Not really. But that was the last night any of us saw him. When I opened my eyes, I brushed the warm roll of tears away. My phone burst to life next to me, the ringtone loud and alien in the dark. I fumble for it. Why would someone be calling me at 2 in the morning? I wonder if it's Chris calling about Waltham House, or if it's Peter, and the story of who I am has leaked already.
Hello there, is that Dr. Lewis?
It's a man's voice, businesslike, professional. Yes, who's calling?
I'm calling from Princess Margaret's. I'm one of the night nurses on the psych ward. Listen, I'm really sorry to call at this hour, but it says on the patient's notes to call you immediately if there's any change.
I sit forward on the bench. What's happened?
Well, I thought you'd want to know that the patient has started talking.
I freeze. He knows who I am and he started talking. What did he say? I ask.
It doesn't make a lot of sense to me, to be honest. But when I went in to do checks about half an hour ago, patient was sitting up in bed reading, and I said, how are we doing tonight, or something like that. You know, just to be polite. I knew he wasn't talking, but then he did. He looked up and he said, I'm fine, thank you. Just like that. And then I asked if he needed anything, and he said he'd like to speak to Dr. Lewis. And then he said to tell you that he's sorry you burnt your fingers that night.
My heart leaps into my throat. My mind races until I suddenly decide I must have heard him wrong. Sorry, what did you say? I hear the wobble in my voice.
I know, sorry. I have no idea what that means either.
No, say it again. Say what he said, I bark.
Okay.
He continues, cowed.
His exact words were, tell Dr. Lewis I'm ready to talk to her. Tell her I'm sorry she burnt her fingers that night. And that was it, really.
He tails off, fearful of further admonishment. I stare out into the shadows beyond the garden, the suffocating darkness of the woods, my breath shallow. He knows things about me, just like Rhoda said. But he couldn't have been there that night. He's sorry I burnt my fingers. How could he know something so intimate, something so slight, unless he'd been there? And if he knows that, what else does he know? And more importantly, what else is he saying at the hospital right now? He's calling me Dr. Lewis now, but he knows my name was Marnie.
Hello? Doctor?
The voice on the line drags me back. Yes, sorry, I'll be there in... I shoot up from the bench and look over the low fence to the frosted windscreen of my car, then down at my sleepwear and socks. I'll be there as soon as I can. Just tell him I'm on my way. Chapter 26. Dr. Emma Lewis. Day 9. What's my name? When I enter the room, he's talking. A few nurses and care assistants clustered around him. His voice is low and calm, but I can already make out a British accent. Not Ukrainian, not Syrian, not any of the other heavily accented dialects that the papers have been so eager to hear him speak. He's just plain old English. He falls silent when he sees me enter, and heads turn in my direction. Their expressions are inscrutable. It's impossible to know what he's told them, what he's already said, if he's mentioned me. I search their faces for clues. He's looking at me as if I'm an old friend he hasn't seen in years, as if we know each other so well. Marnie? He asks simply. It's unmistakable in his tone. He knows me. My glare rakes across the group and their stares scatter like pigeons. I need to say something, I know, and I need to say the right thing. My name is Dr. Lewis. I'm the specialist handling your case. We saw each other very briefly yesterday. Do you remember? I feel bad disregarding his clear recognition of who I am, but we'll get to that in good time, preferably alone. What should I call you? Is Matthew all right? I've confused him. He blinks. Matthew's not my real name. You know that, don't you? He asks. Yes, I know. Do you remember your real name? He looks hurt for a second, and I wonder if I'm being too cold, too distant to this person who so very clearly knows me. I can't remember my name. No. He shakes his head. Would you like us to stop using the name Matthew? Is there another you'd prefer? I ask, my tone gentler now. No. Okay. I make a decision. Would everyone mind stepping out and giving us the room, please? I'm sure you've all got other patients to see to. There are looks of disappointment, but the room quickly clears. Marnie? He says again. He's studying my face intently. He seems less sure this time. This time it really is a question. Why do you keep using that name, Matthew? Because it's your name. I can't remember mine, but I can remember yours.
No shit.
How do you know that name, Matthew? I hold his gaze. If this is some kind of game of chicken, I want him to know I'm up for the challenge.
I don't know. I just do.
He sounds confused. Peter was right. If this guy's faking, he's the best I've ever seen. What else do you know? Do you remember anything else? I make my way over to his bed and sit beside him.
Only glimmers, running through a wood at night.
The memory seems to cause him concern because his face darkens.
I don't know if I'm chasing or being chased.
He looks at me for some kind of reassurance, but I have none to give him. Are you scared in the memory? I ask.
No, not in the memory itself, but when I recall it, it scares me.
Do you think this memory explains how you ended up on the beach 8 days ago?
I don't think so, he hesitates. This memory is old, maybe years ago. It was at night. There was someone there with me. Something went wrong.
He closes his eyes sharply as if to block a thought. I notice his fingers start to tremble in his lap. It's okay, Matthew. I move to him and place a gentle hand on his shoulder. He lets me and I feel the warmth of his skin through his cotton t-shirt. We don't need to go back over it right now. Why don't you tell me about something else? What other things do you remember?
He looks up reluctantly. There are dark circles under his eyes.
Little things, he answers. About people. The people here. I seem to remember these strange things about them. Or rather, I know them. What makes them tick. Things that have happened to them. Things I shouldn't know, but somehow I do. How could that be?
He asks in such a reasonable way that I almost try to answer, but I stop myself. I shake my head instead.
What kind of things do you know about people, Matthew? I ask calmly, trying to keep my desperate need to know at bay.
About you, you mean? What do I know about you?
It's like he can see right through me. He's smart, and yet there doesn't seem to be any edge to what he's saying. How does he know my name? How does he know what happened that night? My heartbeat is so loud it's hard to think. Was he there? Could this be him, somehow?
If you like.
I manage to keep my voice steady. Professional. He raises a hand tentatively towards mine, his touch light and warm. He turns my palm and studies my fingertips.
I realize what he's looking for and my breath catches in my throat.
He finds it. The tiny dashes of white, the almost invisible scars on the side of my two fingers and thumb, the little burn mark I've had since that last bonfire night. His thumb gently brushes the mark, and his gaze finds mine. Yes, he knows what happened that night. It's a crazy thought, but it hits me so hard a wave of emotion rolls up from inside me. He looks sorry. Sorry for what happened. I break his gaze and gently pull back my hand. I asked your name earlier, he says. It's not Marnie anymore. They told me it was Emma Lewis. Why did you change it? Was it because of me? I inhale deeply to mask the shudder I feel run through me, but I can't escape the fact that he really does remind me of someone. There's just something about him. I can't quite place my finger on it yet. I know it can't be him. He died 14 years ago. Why would it be because of you? Who is it that you think you are, Matthew?
I don't know yet. I just have this awful feeling that I did something to you. Did I do something terrible to you?
I suddenly feel sick. I look at his face. It's ridiculous to think it. This isn't him. He looks nothing like him, and besides, I saw the body. This must be some kind of sick joke. But Matthew doesn't look like he's joking. His eyes are earnest, a frown forming between his eyebrows. He's worried by my silence. But I'm genuinely lost for words. This is not a normal situation. I have no framework for this. A sudden instinct flares inside me. He could be dangerous. He could be here to hurt me. This can't be the person I think he is. But he could be someone who knew him. Someone with a reason to come back. I remember what happened the last time I was here, before we left and tried to reinvent our lives. The very real death threats, the vile letters in the post, the terrifying phone calls, anger and poisonous hate after what happened. People wanted revenge. Perhaps someone still does. Matthew watches me from the bed, his handsome face concerned. He certainly doesn't look angry. He looks sad. In a way, isn't that exactly what he would look like if he came back? Oh, don't be ridiculous, Emma. People don't come back. Of course it's not him. He's gone. He's dead. No, I do not know this man. He is a stranger. He's obviously overheard some things about me in the hospital and internalized the story. Memory loss patients will cling to anything that fills the gaps. Often they don't even know where they've picked things up from. It happens all the time. There was a famous psychological experiment done in the 1990s, the Lost in the Mall experiment, where members of a family were reminded about four episodes that happen in their childhoods. Unbeknownst to them, one of the stories, about being lost in a mall, was entirely fabricated. They were then asked to recall the details of what happened to them in each of their four stories. The subjects of the test all ended up clearly recalling being lost in a mall, although the story had never actually happened to them. Each remembered something that never happened, and each had no idea he or she was doing it. We plant our own false memories, and we don't even know we're doing it. Matthew must have heard someone say my old name here, heard the story and unconsciously processed it. That would explain it. However, that does mean that someone here in the hospital knows that I'm Marnie Beaufort. And the only way they could have known I was coming back here was if they'd been keeping an eye on me. I study Matthew's features. Could he have been the one keeping an eye on me? There's one clear way to find out if he's lying. Matthew, would you agree to undergo an fMRI test tomorrow? It's relatively straightforward. It would involve us scanning your brain while I go over some of your memories with you. Do you think you'd be okay to try that with me? He scowls and adjusts his blankets. What's it for? I think about equivocating, but decide instead to show him my cards. The test will tell us if you're lying. What you're suffering from, dissociative fugue, it's extremely rare, but very easy to prove or disprove, and I'd like to do that. It will show us if you can remember or not, and to what extent. Now it's his turn to show me his cards. He doesn't hesitate. I think that would be a very good idea, Dr. Lewis. I pause for a second before nodding. That wasn't exactly how I thought that would go. He 100% believes everything he's saying. He honestly thinks he knows me. The itch to know more is no longer bearable. Matthew, what did you mean when you asked if I had changed my name because of you? Panic flares in his eyes, then fades. I don't know what I did exactly, but I know it was bad. I have these feelings, these awful feelings, they keep bubbling up inside me. He looks down at his hands clasped tight in his lap as if he were praying. I wish I could remember what happened, but I can't, and maybe that's for the best, you know? He looks up at me. I didn't mean to hurt you, any of you, but I knew I had to find you. You had to find me. Have you been looking for me, Matthew? I must have been looking for you. I think that's why I ended up on that beach. I know it seems strange, but I knew you'd come and find me if I waited.
How could I know that? I don't know, I answer honestly. Do you recognize me, Emma? Honestly. I feel a tug in my chest and I hesitate, unsure of how to answer. I don't recognize him, and yet he does remind me of someone so strongly. Why do you think you were trying to find me? I ask instead. He shakes his head. Because... He sighs heavily and takes a ragged breath. Because I put the flame out, honey. His words slam into me, a full body hit, knocking the air right out of me. Oh God, it's him. I feel a rush of nausea. I'm going to be sick. And I want you to know that I'm sorry, Marn. I'm so sorry. I don't stop to think. I stand and leave the room. It's only as I start to run, shoes squeaking down the empty hospital corridor, body shaking, that the vomit comes. Chapter 27. Dr. Emma Lewis. Day 9. FMRI. It starts to snow on my morning run. Great, soft clumps drift down through the gaps in the forest canopy as I follow the track that leads away from the lodge. I only got back from the hospital at around 4 a.m. this morning, so decided to give myself at least 5 hours sleep. I'll go in later. Matthew needs time to rest before we do his fMRI scan anyway. I'll head in after my run, but right now I need time to process exactly what happened last night. After bolting from his room, I managed to pull myself together in the staff locker room, thankfully before anyone saw me. Back in my office, I shot off an email to Nick Dunning, asking him to move around some appointments and fit us into radiology for an fMRI today. When I woke, Nick had replied, telling me he'd booked the fMRI for this afternoon, which is ideal. It gives me enough time to source some prompt images and questions for the test. I let ideas flash through my brain as I run, my trainers crunching over frozen leaves and hardened mud, while the snow floats sleepily down around me and settles. Today I need to distance myself from the patient. I need to put my messy life to one side to diagnose him. While he may remind me of someone long gone, I do not know this man, and I must remember that no matter what he says, he does not know me. I need to keep that foremost in my mind, whatever happens today. God knows how he knows the things he's saying, but there will be a logical explanation, and I need to stay far enough away from the subject matter to find that reason. Back at the lodge, I knock the snow off my shoes and plonk them down by the still-glowing fire. I slept on the living room sofa when I got back last night. Rumpled blankets and pillows, evidence of my stay. Order slowly breaking down. When I get to the hospital, I tell the nursing team to prep Matthew and have him sent up to radiology. I head to my office and email the questions and photos I'll need for the test over to the radiology department as well. Only then do I pick up the phone and call Peter. He's talking, Peter.
Emma?
There's a pause on his end before he speaks again.
Well, that's fantastic. And what's he saying exactly? Anything helpful?
I think carefully before I speak. How much should I tell Peter? He doesn't know his name or who he is, at least that seems to be the impression. You are right, the symptoms seem real. I've ordered an fMRI scan to verify the amnesia and the extent if there is any.
Good. And he's consented to that?
Yes, instantly. It was unusual.
Interesting.
He hesitates.
Look, Emma, I think in this particular case, it might be worth conducting the scan on your own, just in case anything sensitive should come up that we weren't expecting. Perhaps once you've set up, best to have everyone else leave the room.
He lets the idea hang there for a moment. My stomach tightens. Is he worried Matthew might reveal who I am? Sorry, in case what comes up, Peter? He chooses his words carefully.
I know you've signed an NDA, but of course, we can't have everyone at Princess Margaret signing one. I mentioned before there are concerns relating to the patient's identity.
His evasiveness annoys me. Tell me what the concerns are, Peter. If I'm going to lock myself in a room with him, I think I deserve to know.
Ah, well, yes, I suppose if you put it like that. There is a concern from the Ministry of Defence that the patient may be military. A missing person. Obviously, it's not ideal that this is only coming to light now, but there we go. There are some conversations going on re-jurisdiction. Nothing to be concerned about just yet.
What the hell does the Ministry of Defence know about Matthew? Peter, what makes them think he's military? What's informed that conclusion? I hear the sharpness of my tone.
I'm afraid I'm not privy to that just yet, Emma. But if it becomes relevant, then I'm sure we'll be informed.
Peter, come on. Am I at risk here? From my patient? I need to know. Do the MOD think he's dangerous? There's a silence on the line, which isn't comforting at all. I suddenly feel so far outside my comfort zone that I almost consider just hanging up. But Peter's voice cuts in just in time.
No, no. I don't think it's that sort of situation, Emma. I certainly don't believe so. That hasn't been mentioned by anyone at this stage. I'm confident we would have been forewarned if it was anything like that. But of course, I would say, use your own best judgment on this, Dr. Lewis.
Wow. Thanks, Peter. When I reach radiology, Matthew is already safely in position on the MRI tray bed, his head strapped inside the plastic headframe, his face hidden from sight. Rhoda is leaning over him, explaining the procedure. She looks up when I enter and rests Matthew's hand back down onto the bed. Rhoda, I'm going to need the room to myself once we get started. No other staff members present. Are you okay with that? She looks surprised, but eager to assist. If that's what you need, then I can definitely do that. Yes, doctor. Great. I've already spoken with the radiologist, so it will just be Matthew and me. I think the more straightforward we keep this for him, the better. Of course. She nods and turns back towards the man on the bed. I'll get him in and ready, and then just let me know and I'll slip out. Once Matthew is safely inside the machine, Rhoda makes her way out of the room with a smile. I seal the ward doors behind her and slip into the control room, engaging the magnetic shield door behind me, sealing Matthew in the MRI room. I find my seat in the control room console, and through the thick glass that separates me from Matthew, I watch the MRI bed's smooth motion into the machine. I lean forward and turn on the mic in front of me. Matthew, it's Dr. Lewis, can you hear me? I watch his face spring to life on the video screen as my voice comes through his headphones. He opens his mouth to answer. I won't be able to hear you, Matthew, so try not to speak. Just use the keyboard Rhoda gave you to answer. Press either yes or no. You'll see the questions on the screen above you, and you just need to answer yes or no. Rhoda should have given you an emergency squeeze ball as well. I want you to squeeze that as hard as you can if you start to feel concerned in any way or if you need us to stop, okay? I watch the screen. He taps yes. Good, that's great, Matthew. Now, basically, this is how it works. The fMRI will show me the areas of your brain that receive the most oxygenated blood when you perform a task or when you respond to any stimuli. Those will be the areas you're using to perform whatever function we're testing. We're going to start by taking a basic structural scan, so just relax and try not to move. Those banging noises are the pictures being taken, so don't worry when you hear them. Now, it's very important you don't move during the scan, or the image will be blurry. He taps again. Yes. Excellent. You won't hear my voice for about 8 minutes while the scan is underway, okay? He squeezes his eyes together briefly. Yes. Okay, here we go. I turn off my mic and initiate the structural scan. I watch his face on the screen as the fMRI pounds noisily to life, and the first images of his brain begin to take shape on the next monitor. He looks calm in spite of the overwhelming intensity of the machine thundering around him, and I wonder if what Peter hinted at could be true, if he has some kind of military training.
I've known the sounds and confinement inside those fMRI units to make the manliest of men uneasy. But not Matthew. He looks perfectly at ease. I lean forward and quickly jot down a final question for the scan. It can't hurt. The screen flashes. I turn on the mic again. That was great, Matthew. Nice, clear images. Now we're going to dive right into the next couple of tests. Is that okay? I watch his face on the screen. He smiles and taps yes. I need you to perform an action in this test. I want you to tap each finger in turn on the thumb of your right hand and just keep doing that until the screen above you says stop. Yes. We steam through the basic brain activation tests, motor function, sound processing, visual processing, and then we get to the meat of the scan. Okay, Matthew. Now, I'm going to show you some images on the screen. I just want you to think about what you see, how the images make you feel, and what they remind you of. You don't need to direct your thoughts in any particular way. It will all just happen naturally, so just relax. Yes. Then if you're okay with that, we'll go straight into the question portion of the scan. A question will show on your screen. All you need to do is choose a simple yes or no answer. He pauses a second before tapping yes. You're doing great, Matthew. Don't worry about a thing. He smiles, and I click off the mic. I set up the photo sequence and press start. A photograph of an empty beach. His eyes flick fast over the image, pupils dilating fractionally. He inhales sharply. I watch the fMRI light up. His cortex now aglow, pulsing as it processes the image. Then his amygdala, the fight or flight center, blazes, processing his emotional response to the stimuli. Immediately followed by that, a flare in his hippocampus. Relevant memories are being sourced. Memory retrieval 101. Matthew remembers being on a beach. But then we knew that, didn't we? I check the video link. He's very pale. I check his vital signs. His pulse is slightly raised. To be expected. The last time he was on a beach must have been absolutely terrifying. Now to test whether his memories go back any further than that day on the beach. I flick to the next photo in the sequence. A stock family photo. A young couple, each holding a child in their arms. I watch the fMRI images as they register. Cortex. Only a dim glow from the amygdala, and nothing from the hippocampus. Interesting. Either Matthew can't remember having a wife and child, or he's never had either. I flick to the next picture. Another family photo, this time from the 1980s. A couple in their 40s with a 7-year-old son. It's more formal in style. I've chosen a stock image from the 1980s, so it will resonate more with Matthew's memories of being a boy and potential memories of his own parents, if he can access them. I watch the fMRI screen. Visual cortex glows. And then the amygdala leaps to life, a burst of brain activity blazing on the screen, an extremely strong emotional reaction to the idea of parents or childhood. But as I study the dark mass of the hippocampus, there's nothing. Nothing. He has no memories of a family. I realise I'm holding my breath. I double-check the screen. No. There's no activation. He really can't remember. A fizz of excitement thrills through me. Matthew might be the first fully verifiable case of fugue. In spite of everything that's happened after the last 2 days, I feel a bright burst of joy inside. I can't help but smile to myself. Buoyed, I flick to the final image. A thick green forest fills the screen. I watch his face on the screen, his pupils widening as he makes sense of it. Last night, Matthew mentioned having one clear memory of being in a wood. I look to the fMRI screen. His visual cortex activates, but his amygdala is strangely subdued given how he spoke about the memory. I studied the screen, and then a sudden flash, An intense burst of activation in the hippocampus, a flash of memory. I jolt forward, leaning closer to the screen, and a constellation of areas in the cerebral cortex glow in answer to the initial flash. I've never seen anything like it. Such a localized and specific reaction. I glance at his amygdala again. There's hardly any emotional engagement. No emotional connection to these memories. My focus is pulled by a sudden low beeping below the screen. The lower screen is flashing. Matthew's heart rate has soared well above the recommended level. I hover my hand above the fMRI's emergency stop button and turn to check on his face on the video screen. Then I pull back my hand in surprise. Matthew's face is utterly calm. His breathing is normal. I check the readouts again. His heart is pounding. He should be hyperventilating, but none of it is visible. The bright areas of his brain's centre for self-control, the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, are glowing with vivid intensity. Somehow he's masking it, suppressing it. He's using self-control. Incredible self-control. I click off the last photo and reset the system, taking a second to shake off the oddness of what just occurred. I let his heart rate settle. We need clear readings for the next portion of the test, the most important portion. After a moment, I turn on the mic again. Matthew, are you okay to continue? Yes. I check his vitals, and everything has made its way back to the appropriate levels. I guess we're safe to move on. I bring up the Q&A intro screen, explaining that I will not speak, but he should respond to the text on the screen by pushing either yes or no on his keypad. Yes. I start the sequence. Were you found on a beach? Yes. His hippocampus activates briefly, the same as before. Do you know your name? Matthew pauses for a microsecond, then taps no. His hippocampus does not activate, although his amygdala flares and his heart rate spikes. Do you know what happened to you before you found yourself on the beach? Matthew closes his eyes. No. No activation in the hippocampus, only amygdala and dorsolateral. That's fascinating. Self-control again. I pause, finger poised over the final question in the sequence. His pulse is high, but not above recommended levels. I click the next question. There's no simpler way to find out if we're dealing with a dangerous man, someone who the military might be concerned about misplacing. Have you killed? He looks directly up at the screen, his pupils contracting as if he can see right through the camera to me. He seems to hold my gaze, unflinching and steady. On the fMRI, his dorsolateral glows white-hot, overshadowing everything else. There's that self-control again. The bleeping starts once more on the screen below, and I tear my eyes away from his. His heart rate is way too high, tachycardic. I hit the emergency stop button on the fMRI machine and jump up to release the control room shield door. I heave it open and race into the scanning room, slamming my palm into the bed release mechanism on the side of the machine. The hydraulic system kicks in, and the bed glides out achingly slowly from the bulk of the fMRI. I see him now. He's gasping for breath, head still lodged in the head brace, hands fumbling with its clasps. I run to him and swiftly unhook the fastenings. Matthew, are you all right? Can you hear me? He clutches at his chest now, desperate, deep in the throes of a panic attack. He can't breathe. My eyes swing to the readout next to him. His blood oxygen is lethally low at 50. I look around the room, but there's no one here to assist me. Damn it. I smash my hand into the emergency call buzzer and grab an fMRI-safe oxygen tank, wheeling it quickly to the bed. I push the head brace away, and twisting the tank valve, I slide the mask safely over his face before I kick off my shoes and scramble up behind Matthew on the bed. I pull him back towards me, cradling him. His head and shoulders resting against my chest, my legs crossed in front of me. It's not flattering, but I've got him. I slide one arm under his shoulder and brace him. I need to calm him,
To get him to slow his breathing. I need to lower his ludicrously high heart rate. He needs to breathe. I hold him tight. Shh, shh, Matthew, it's okay. I soothe, but he struggles against me, wheezing and fighting for breath. It's okay, Matthew. You just need to calm down. Breathe, slow. Everything is fine. Just breathe. He loosens back into me, his breath still snatching noisily in his throat. But at least he's listening to my voice. That's it, Matthew. Good. Now nice and slow. In through your nose, out through your mouth. Good, that's perfect. Everything is going to be okay, Matthew. He takes a noisy breath in through his nose and lets it out audibly through his mouth. Good. That's good. I'm right here. Everything is fine, I promise you. I feel the weight of him against me. His fear. His trust, his vulnerability. There wasn't time to get an fMRI reading on that final question. Have you killed? But in a way, what just happened might be answer enough. Chapter 28. Dr. Emma Lewis. Day 10. A visit from Joe. Matthew is recovering on the ward. It's Friday, so a tentative day off, to the extent that a doctor on call can ever really have a day off. When I open the front door of the lodge, I find that everything is smothered in thick white. There must have been another flurry of snow overnight. The forest branches bend low with sparkling weight, while the garden, bench, and long lane all the way to the road glitter brilliantly in the sharp winter sunlight. I zip up my down jacket to my chin, pat my pocket to feel for the plastic lump of my hospital pager, and scrunch briskly out across the snow to my car. I'm heading to the train station to pick Joe up. I texted him late last night, and like the hero that he is, he texted back that he'd drop everything and come first thing. I need someone to talk to. Some perspective, just for a day. He can't stay the night, as Rachel's working tonight and can't watch Chloe, but at least I'll have a few hours' company. I drive through the fresh winter wonderland, the radio playing in my car the only sound in the muffled white. After everything bad that happened to me, it's still impossibly beautiful, this place. Thankfully, it turns out that they do salt the main roads, even this far out of town. But as I turn off into the rural station lane, I see the council budget obviously doesn't stretch this far. When I reach the station entrance, Joe's waiting, ankle deep in snow, beaming from ear to ear, the only one on the platform. He pulls me into a hug as soon as he jumps into the car. He holds me tight for a long time, my left leg jamming hard against the handbrake, but I don't pull away. I need his love. "There you are," he says. "Here I am," I agree, my head buried in his jacket, safe for a second. I suggest we head back to Cuckoo Lodge and have some hot chocolate before we head out for a cold walk along the beach. Joe's already wrapped up warm in a barber and wellies, but I need to grab some boots. Joe keeps the conversation ticking over on the short drive, diplomatically sensing I'm not quite ready to talk about anything more serious just yet. He tells me Mum's fine with me being here. Whatever I need to do for myself, I should do, she says. He tells me about his little Chloe and her obsession with his briefcase. I'm glad of the distraction. I need to clear my head and reset my bearings before I can talk to someone else about what's happening here. I knew I needed Joe. I sense him tense slightly when we pass a sign for Burnham Market, at least 20 miles from Holt and our old house. No one else but me would notice, but the story he's telling me about Chloe gets a little louder, a little funnier. He hasn't been back here either since it happened. I've forced him back. He's here for me. I glance across at his face as he talks, and I wonder how he stayed so well adjusted, so sane, so lovely, with his job and his wife and his gorgeous baby girl. I'm not jealous. I'm amazed and incredibly grateful to have someone like him in my life. As I head down the drive leading to Cuckoo Lodge, Joe gives a low whistle of appreciation. I feel an odd sense of pride. The house is beautiful, especially in the snow. And as an architect, its beauty isn't wasted on Joe. "Oh, sweet Jesus," he murmurs. "This is where they put you. This is part of the Holcomb estate, right?" "I don't know, is it? It's definitely Victorian." "Yeah, no shit, Sherlock." I laugh, and he leans forward to study the chimneys, the cornicing, through the windscreen. "Like?" I tease. I make us our hot chocolate and we carry them out into the back garden with some blankets so we can enjoy the winter sun on our faces. And almost immediately, Joe broaches the subject we've both been evading. "So, shouldn't you be at work? Isn't that what they're paying you for?" He smiles and sips his chocolate. "I thought you were supposed to be encouraging me to work less," I say with a surprised laugh. But inside I feel a sharp pang of guilt. My patient is still ill. I could be doing something, but instead of working, I'm here. I know I can't work 7 days a week, but time off always makes me uneasy. There's not really much I can do at this stage, Joe. My patient's talking now, but his memory is limited. And yesterday was pretty intense. I told him to take it easy today. I've got a big day planned tomorrow and he needs rest. I'm going to take him on a trip, visit some places that might trigger some memories. He must have got to that beach somehow. We'll try the roads nearby, local stations, anywhere he might have been just prior to being found. He's making me a list today of anywhere he can think of that might help. But aside from that, there's really nothing I can do. And I'm on call if anything comes up. I can be there in 30 minutes. Are you going to tell me what's going on? He asks when I've finished. He's no longer smiling. Or have you just invited me down here for my sparkling conversation? Oh, God, Joe, it's so... well, it's beyond weird, I suppose. I blurt out. The patient... he knows who I am. My patient. Isn't that a good sign? He hasn't grasped what I've just said. He's grinning. No, no, it's not, Joe. He knows my real name. I feel a selfish relief when I see his smile freeze, because now I know it's not just me going through this anymore. Misery loves company. He called me Marnie. He knows what happened. He knows all about Dad. What do you mean? Exactly that. Yesterday morning he just started talking out of the blue. He said he needed to talk to me, and when he did, he said he was sorry, Joe, about what he did. To us. To everyone. He said he was sorry I burnt my fingers. I let that fact hang in the air between us. Joe grimaces and empties his drink into the snow. After a moment he says, "Who does he think he is?" "Dad?" He's deadly serious now. "I think so, yes." "Christ! And you do too, don't you?" "Oh, don't be ridiculous, Joe. Of course I don't. He's about 20 years younger and he looks nothing like him. I don't know what the fuck is going on here. I want to weep." "Do you recognise him at all?"
"No."
"And he's not one of Dad's old work friends or something?"
"Too young."
"You think he's still alive, don't you?" The bluntness of it shocks me. I pause too long. "He's gone, Emma. Remember? You saw, we saw. We buried him. He's not somewhere out there. This isn't him. This isn't someone he sent. I don't know what this is, but it's not that."
I break from his gaze and stare out at the sparkling forest. "It's some kind of misunderstanding. Or it's a trick, Em."
"It's not a trick, Joe. If there's one thing I know for certain, it's that my patient isn't lying. He really can't remember. He wouldn't be able to fake the scans I put him through yesterday."
"Then he must have picked up these ideas somewhere else, right? Overheard things. Someone might be putting him up to it."
"That's what I thought, but that still means someone at the hospital knows. That they know I was coming even before I got there, which is weird, Joe. My patient said my name the first time we met. But you said he only started talking yesterday.
Officially, yes. I didn't mention it to anyone at the time, but he said my name on the first day.
I heard him. He whispered it.
He what?
He frowns.
Whispered it? Are you sure?
He mumbled it. It wasn't threatening or anything.
Why the hell didn't you tell anyone? Why didn't you say something?
He stares at me, incredulous. I look away, down at the hot chocolate in my hand. My fingers are freezing.
You know why, Joe, and because I thought maybe I'd imagined it.
Bloody hell, Em. You really shouldn't be back here, should you?
I know, Joe, I know. Please, just help me out. I need you to help me out here.
Okay, so he shakes his head with disbelief and refocuses on the facts. Someone at the hospital knew you were coming here before you arrived because your patient was there days before you even agreed to treat him. And this someone knew that Emma Lewis was Marnie Beaufort.
How could they know that, Emma?
The police are the only people who know we've changed our names, and that was years ago. It's protected information. How could anyone find out?
I think of Chris. Chris the policeman, with his database and his searches. Shit. I can't tell Joe about Chris. But that's not all of it. Oh God, this is going to sound so insane. But I think he might be dangerous.
What? Who? Your patient?
Yeah, I'm not supposed to talk about him. I signed an NDA, but the government seems to think he could possibly have some kind of military background. They won't tell me. It's classified.
Joe slams his empty mug down hard onto the snow-covered table.
What the hell is going on up here? You shouldn't be asked to do things like this. You don't have training in that.
Suddenly, my pager buzzes to life in my pocket. The hospital. I throw a look to Joe as I grab it from my pocket and check the display. Shit, one second, I need to call them. He eyeballs me as I rise and head deeper into the garden.
Hi, it's Dr. Lewis, I answer.
Oh, okay, really? I see. Okay, well, is there someone in particular I should be speaking to? Right, okay, and can I speak to DC Barker now?
I lock eyes with Joe as I say this new name, his eyebrows raise.
Okay, I continue into the receiver. Wait, no, sorry. I do not give my consent to that at all, no. I'd have to discuss...
Well, I understand that, of course.
Right, well, I'll be there as soon as I can. Thank you for letting me know.
I hang up and turn to Joe.
The Metropolitan Police are at the hospital. They've taken over from the local police force. Apparently, they now think he's some boy that went missing, was abducted in the early 90s, Benjamin Taylor. The police have got a social worker with them and they're trying to get access to the ward right now. Apparently, they want to question him about it before he meets the parents.
Jesus Christ, Joe exclaims.
First they think he's a soldier, now he's some missing kid.
God knows what evidence they think they have, Joe, but he's not ready for this kind of shit. Even the most basic questioning is triggering panic attacks. If they wade in with no proper medical training and start questioning him about being held in captivity for almost 30 years, God knows what kind of trauma that will cause, especially if they're right about it.
I dash into the house and grab my car keys, Joe following after, incredulous. Stop, Em. Just stop.
Stop what you're doing, he barks, bringing me instantly to a standstill.
Joe never raises his voice.
Em, listen to me. This situation is insane.
I read the concern on his face. You should not be putting yourself through this. There is no need for it. Let someone else do this job.
You shouldn't be back here. I know we talked it through before you agreed, but I didn't realise it would be like this.
With the police and press and what's going on with this particular patient. Plus, I thought you were in a better place yourself, Em. You made me think you would be able to handle all of this, coming back here. I can handle it, Joe, I protest fiercely. But I know I'm lying, because Joe wouldn't be here if I could handle it, would he? Shit. We can just go home, you know? Right now. You can just call the hospital and tell whoever you need to tell that you're resigning. The world won't collapse. We can just go. I mean, the Met showing up unannounced sounds like a pretty good reason to step back anyway, doesn't it? I feel my resolve falter. He's right. There's something so incredibly off about all of this. But then I remember Matthew's words that first night. How could he have known those things unless he'd been there that night, or known someone who was? I need to know who he is. I think of his trust in me yesterday as he struggled for breath. I push the feeling away. No, I said I'd do it, Joe. I told my patient I'd help him. I promised him that everything would be okay. Joe's tone softens. That's not your call, Emma. You don't get to control whether everything is okay or not. You're not omnipotent. You can only do your best. This is too much. For someone so intelligent, you can be so stupid. Let someone else handle this. This guy, whoever he turns out to be, is not your responsibility. No, Joe, he is. He actually is, because that's my job. I wish I could leave it to someone else, but no one else here has my expertise. I'm the only person here medically who can help him. I'm saying it, but I don't know if it's true. I'm sure there are other doctors Peter could call. Maybe Richard Groves could take over remotely. Perhaps it might be better for Matthew, for me, if I did step aside, given his strange connection to me. I take in Joe's exasperated face. All right, I say finally. I'll stop. I'll just do the rest of today, okay? I'll tell them I need to hand over. Joe holds my gaze. Promise? You'll sort this Met thing out, then you'll let them know you're done. You're resigned from this case. Yes, I say, fingering the car keys in my hand. If Matthew is the missing Benjamin Taylor, then all of my questions about how he knows me are redundant anyway, aren't they? The sooner I find out if he's Benjamin, the sooner I'll know this is all in my head. But right now, I really need to go in, Joe. He sighs and then nods. I'll come to the hospital with you. Get the train back from King's Lynn. You can call me later. Let me know how it goes. I turn back to him. Wait, Joe, I don't think you should come to the hospital. He looks confused, so I explain. The press found out Matthew was talking yesterday and they're all over the hospital. I don't want you to have to go through that. It's like before. The colour drains from his cheeks and he swallows before rallying. Well, they better watch out, hadn't they? Because I don't know about you, but I've certainly learnt a few tricks since then. He gives a winning smile just as my phone explodes into life again. Chapter 29. Dr. Emma Lewis. Day 10. Tinker, Taylor, Soldier, Spy. Media tents line the back of the car park like festival booths. There are television trucks, presenters getting makeup touch-ups while they scan scripts. Production runners are dashing back and forth. Someone's even set up a food truck to feed them all. And I thought it was bad when I left last night after the news broke that Matthew was talking. It seems I'm the last to hear about the Met's involvement in the case. I feel Joe shift in the car seat next to me. Oh God, I shouldn't have brought him here. Why did I let him come? They recognize my car as soon as I pull up to the staff bay and start shouting and running towards me. They know who I am, Mr. Nobody's doctor. And they know that if I'm back at the hospital, then something is definitely happening. I look to Joe. He nods and pops his car door. Thankfully, I catch sight of the security chief, Trevor, ahead of the throng rushing towards us. When he gets close enough, he eyes Joe before launching into an update. The Met just gave a press statement out front. The parents are on their way, apparently, he curses. These lot are all here to see the Taylors. I catch Joe's eye. Jesus. A barrage of questions rolls towards me. Dr. Lewis, can you confirm that Matthew is the missing Taylor child?
Benjamin Taylor disappeared in September 1992. Do you have any knowledge of his whereabouts over the 27 years he's been missing? Have you spoken with the parents yet, Dr. Lewis? I become aware that a camera crew is now filming us as we walk. The cameraman is walking backwards in front of us as our strange parade rushes on. Is the patient making a speedy recovery, Dr. Lewis? Does he have any memory yet of the trauma he's been through? Was he held against his will for the duration? Can we expect to see Benjamin out of hospital soon, Doctor? Trevor fends them off, holding the crowd back as we head inside. When we break through into the lobby, I gasp in a breath, and three security guards block the way of the press after us. The doors slide shut, muffling their shouted questions. I try to keep my expression neutral, even though every pore wants to scream, "Leave us alone." I'm keenly aware that we're still on camera. Joe's expression is unreadable, except for his eyes. In them I see that haunted look I remember so well. We've been through walks like this before, Joe and I, and they don't get easier. As I leave Joe with Trevor to head back to the train station via the back entrance, he hugs me tight. "Call me after you've done it," he whispers. Matthew is waiting for me on the ward. He's standing with his back to me, staring out the window at the crisp winter blue of the open sky, not a cloud in sight. "They told me I might be called Benjamin. I don't feel like a Benjamin." He speaks with a lightness that almost breaks my heart. "I'm sorry this is all happening to you, Matthew. I don't really understand yet on what basis they're making this connection." He turns to face me. "Do you think they could be right? Is this who I am, Benjamin Taylor?" "I don't know," I say, sitting down on his bed to work it through properly for the first time. "Let's look at the facts." Joe managed to find an old news story from the 90s on his phone on the drive here. "Here's what the authorities know. 12-year-old Benjamin Taylor left his house in Tottenham on the 27th of September 1992 to walk to school. But he never made it there. At the time, there was a national search for him. They did a reconstruction of his last movements and they questioned a number of suspects, but Benjamin was never seen again. I'm careful now. His parents didn't stop looking, though. They were very vocal during the campaign, and they've kept up a website for Benjamin all this time. Benjamin's father has been checking the missing persons database every week since. That's how they saw your photo." Matthew looks at me. "That's a sad story." "Yes, it is," I say solemnly as he sits down next to me. "But what would I have been doing for the past 27 years? God, what a question. I'm not sure, Matthew. But if I had to make this fit in any plausible way, which we really don't have to do, but if I had to, I'd say that the fact that your circadian rhythm is completely screwed up could potentially be down to a lack of natural light. If you'd been kept somewhere, your head wound, your memory loss, all of it could point towards trauma received during some kind of escape. The police must have a reason for suspecting you're Benjamin. Plus, the Taylors seem to recognise you. And you are the right age. You think I've been in a basement for almost 30 years. That's your theory." I can't help but smile slightly. "No, I don't think you've been in a basement for 27 years, but that could be what they're thinking. How would I have escaped from this hypothetical basement?" "I don't know, but I'm guessing it would definitely be possible for a man of your height and build to overpower a man in his, by now, say his 60s. I can't help it, but I giggle slightly at this. "Oh, God, this is awful. This is a horrible story, Emma," he says with that lightness of tone again. "Thankfully, right now, he has no connection to this story. I mean, even if he is Benjamin Taylor, let's not make him remember being Benjamin Taylor. Nobody wants to be the person who was potentially locked in a basement for decades. They want to meet you, the parents," I say carefully, watching his reaction. "I'll pull the plug on this in a heartbeat if he needs me to." "Why do they want to do that?"
Because they want to know if you're their son, I'd imagine. He rises and walks over to the window. But even if I am, he says, looking down at the media swarming below, I'm not really, am I? I don't remember being anyone's son yet. No, you certainly can't be expected to be someone you don't even remember. Silence fills the room, and when he speaks again, I jump slightly at the sound. Who do you think I am? He demands. I can't read his expression against the stark light of the window. I don't know, Matthew. That's what we're all trying to find out, isn't it? I know, but you. Who do you really think I am? Not as my doctor, not as my psychiatrist, but as a person. I stifle a shudder. I can't tell him who I think he is. The man I think he is died 14 years ago. Matthew moves away from the light and his face comes into sight, his intelligent eyes studying me. I push the thought away, taking a moment before answering. I think there's a possibility you may have been in the military. I think you could be suffering from PTSD. Of course, there is the possibility that the PTSD could be from any kind of trauma, but I think it's unlikely that you have been held against your will for the last 27 years. That much seems clear to me, both professionally and as a person. He studies me, then nods. Okay, makes sense. He sits down in the visitor's chair and rubs his face. I'll meet them, he says decisively, if it helps them. But I have no interest in being Benjamin Taylor. For a moment I think I've misheard him. It's such a strange way to put it, but I understand what he means. He doesn't believe it's true, but he wants to see if it triggers something. He needs to know, and he wants to help these people. Perhaps he is Benjamin. At this stage, he could be anyone. Are you sure you want to do this? I ask. As long as you're there. Yes.